facility with the prize, if there's no question that it's added to the automatic credentials. And I suspect that when I was introduced to the Kennedys and asked to serve on the health team, that did have something to do with it, that I represented scientific medicine on the health team. I guess I was the person to do that. So there's a kind of self-fulfilling aspect of that. You get more experience. Hopefully you did a good job. You'll be noticed for other such opportunities and so on, and you start paying more attention. I felt I needed to enhance my policy education, and can't accurately describe how I did that, but I would pay close attention to seminars in sociology, history, political science, economics, and so on. And, not that my reading in those fields began at that time, but it was certainly accentuated as part of that process. I'm kind of approaching an answer to your question, but I'm trying to fill in a little more of the background. 1961, I was invited to a symposium of the SIBA Foundation on Man's
right.
Biological Future.
Right.
And don't take offense at the word man. It meant human.
Right,
okay.
Right.
And that set me thinking for the first time a little bit more systematically about what was going to be the human impact of the new biology that I was one of the creators of, and I tried to systematize my thoughts for the paper that I gave at that time. One of my conclusions was the future was going to be richer than the past. Don't try to settle everything today. The technical environment will be totally transforming. And don't try to fix every problem today. We don't know that much diagnostically, and the therapeutic modalities will be infinitely greater. So that was my rebuttal to the eugenicists. You got a very clumsy methodology.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really sure what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There are issues about trying to forestall, you know, this became the negative eugenics of at least let's forestall deleterious mutations and try to save for malformations. I couldn't argue against it. But then that says let's focus on the individual baby. I don't want deformed babies born.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my objective rather than purifying the gene pool.
Now, was that the conference where you introduced the, well,
eugenics.
Is the word eugenics?
Yeah, exactly.
Is that where you introduced it?
That was
it?
My counter slogan.
Okay.
And in a way, it is a stalling action. Let's deal with today's phenotypes and worry about
mm-hmm.
tomorrow's genotypes tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Muller, I guess, was not there, but read a paper. Julian Huxley stood for that movement, and he was still talking rather vehemently about the negative eugenics side. So, to the extent I had a debate, it was with Huxley. That's what framed that argument. Anyhow, that got me starting to think a little bit more deeply, and I began bringing that into some of my teaching. Nobody else was talking about cloning or genetic engineering. So these are some of the very first discussions of those issues. And I, to some degree, got caught up in it myself. So from 61 till roughly 67, it partially overlaps when I started writing my columns, I was pretty much preoccupied with those kinds of issues. Just as the word dogma is a joke, I use the term alchemy for genetic alchemy, and both, what's his name, Primke, yeah, at Tufts, and Jeremy Rifkin, of all things, have taken it much too seriously. They have no sense of humor whatsoever. Well, it was kind of poking a little bit of fun, but still saying there are things to be thinking about and not wanting to keep any secrets about what was coming along. So I spent those 5 years catharsizing myself about what I really felt about those matters. And I have to say, from about 67 on, I then got kind of tired of it. I didn't feel there was that much more to be said. I was going to say the same things over and over again. So I published a few things in that genre and then said that was my last word. So more or less is. Now I can pull out the publication that I still stand on as
mm-hmm.
being surveyed. So if you'd like that, I'll identify it for you.
That might be helpful.
Okay. Now, when it comes to more, you were asking about more public involvement, which committees and so forth.
Or which ones you felt were the most, I guess, important from a science policy perspective?
Well, certainly the Kennedy Health Transition Team There were a few things there. There were, first of all, its specific policy recommendations in bolstering of Medicare, support for biomedical research as a built-in part of the health agenda, and there was a call there, and I don't recall if it actually survived the final report to the president. It's one of the versions, but not the other, so I guess the president didn't accept it as a formal recommendation. But I called for establishing a national academy, I think I called the National Academy of Medicine, to be a counterpart to the National Academy of Sciences to provide the same sort of expert advice on health policy matters, so that was a mm-hmm. process matter. Well, in one way or another, that was the precursor of the Institute of Medicine, although only a few people knew about it, and it was an idea that was revived in any number of forms. I think I can say it did have that. It was part of the history of ideas of that particular enterprise. Now, that was a pretty high leverage unit. I mean, that was reporting directly, through the chairman, but directly to the president. I decided to go into writing columns. For one thing, I just got sick and tired of travel. I was doing so much of it for NASA that between 1961 and 1965, I think I actually succeeded, 62 to 66, something like that, in not traveling cross-country at all for that interval. So that says I wasn't on any national committees, and I was fighting them off. I wanted to find other. I wanted to do my own thinking. I wanted to have other avenues of influence. And it's a complicated story, but instead I got into writing a weekly column, and that brought me up to 71. Uh-huh. And there I declined service on the President's Science Advisory Committee. I thought it would be a conflict of interest to be somebody writing all and telling all on the one hand and receiving confidential information mm-hmm. on the other. Mm-hmm. I was probably using that as an excuse again to not, but there was something to that. I couldn't. If I was using all the information at my disposal, which I assume a writer for the public, particularly a regular columnist, is expected to do, it'd get a little hairy if you hear things in confidence you then can't talk about. Mm-hmm. So I stayed off. So it wasn't until the late 60s that I started going on. Then they were mostly not high policy matters. There were tactical things, NSF panels, NIH panels, study sections, things of that sort.
And at some point in the 70s, you became involved in...
I'm trying to remember what committee that was in.
Yeah, well, this is just kind of a fragment from one of your organizations, from one of your outlines that mentioned something about national security involvement in the 70s.
Yeah,
how did you get involved in that?
Oh, yeah, no, that was the big thing. That was the big turning point in spite of my... one of the consequences, and it did have big repercussions, one of the consequences of some of the things I was writing in the column is that the direction I was taking aligned to what the Nixon administration decided it was going to do about biological weapons arms control. Mm-hmm. And that was a separation of the BW and the CW issues. Mm-hmm. Now, the moral stance on BW was so much more compelling that a lot of my colleagues regretted my severing them because they thought they could use that as leverage to get a more comprehensive agreement. I felt the moral stance on BW was so compelling that we had to get that at all costs. And I thought it would be a long time before we'd get a CW arms control agreement because it was an established weapon. It was something that had been used widely in World War I. The military weren't comfortable with it, but they knew what to do with it. They were going to squawk about giving it up. And then there were the quasi-CW going on in Vietnam, which brought in a wholly different set of controversies, which greatly clouded it. They may have been the main motive for some of the other folks. There was a way to do some Nixon bashing. But I wanted to solve the BW problem. It wasn't that I was very fond of Nixon, but I really was quite fixated on that. So I suddenly got a call from the Arms Control Agency. Would I advise them in Geneva during the negotiations and maybe speak to the Committee on Disarmament at the UN? That was a totally new level of territory for me, and I obviously hastened to say yes, and was quite deeply involved in that process as a result. Two or three impacts. We had a 30th anniversary of that event not long ago, the negotiation of the treaty. I had a couple of people who had been there in Geneva, came to this UN meeting and said, Dr. Lederberg, you don't realize what an impact you made with your talk. And we diplomats were trouncing around, and the picture you painted, if we didn't come to terms, was really so horrifying, it really helped us beat it into shape. I didn't know that it had that deep an impact. I've had that testimony in several places. So it takes to get some credit for the actual bringing to terms of the treaty. So it's a flawed treaty, but it's the best we're ever going to get. I think it's been a very important step in delegitimating BW. It's not that it's easy to enforce it, but at least that's the status of the law at this point. So I put that tops on the list, and it's sort of right at the beginning of that sequence. Then a little bit after that, I started getting nibbles from the Defense Science Board, from other defense-oriented places, the intelligence community. And precisely because most of the academic world was boycotting those agencies at that time, I felt the moral obligation to come to terms with them. That if they didn't hear some, what I would call, voice of reason from in-house, they weren't going to get it anywhere else, and there was just going to be such mutual polarization that it would end up being much worse.
So sort of a working within the system.
Exactly. So I realize that's working with the devil, but I made that decision. And that more or less coincided with my ending my public persona in writing the columns. That was coming to an end anyhow. So I felt able to go into getting clearances, dealing with classified information and so on, if I was no longer writing weekly columns. So I think until recently, my not very visible contributions have been in the national security side, some degree of sanity and what we need by way of weapons programs, what chances we should be taking in arms control agreements and pressing for international convergence in a wide variety of areas, and I continue to do that. And I was a very lonely character for some time during the height and still ongoing, you know, raging about the Vietnam War. I never gave it any support of any kind. I would chide myself for not having been more openly and aggressively against it. You know, people like McNamara said how totally wrong it was to have been a proponent. I will say it was wrong for me to not be more aggressively opposed to it. I didn't think it was all one-sided. I didn't think much of the benevolence of the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong. They were just as imperialistic as the other side. But perfectly obvious that it would have been a better outcome for everybody if we had not supported South Vietnam, but that's now that we know the outcome. So.
Right.
And what an enormous human cost that entailed. What was flawed was the domino doctrine, and that I have to lay right at McCarthy's feet. It seems to be going back a few years, but he expunged every trace of expertise on East Asian and Russian politics in our State Department, our security organization. And while there undoubtedly were some people who had communist commitments, I think much more harm than good came out of it. And this is one of the proofs, is to have such a one-sided view of that dynamic. So.
Okay.
So that takes us to the early 70s and so on. Most of what I do and have done in connection with DOD is not very public, and it isn't that discreet. It's very hard to point to one single thing, but I think a lot of what's happened in those agencies would be even more insane if they didn't have a few folks like myself willing to listen and willing to talk back and willing to do it on a close-in basis. Subsequent to that, I've become more concerned about the enforcement of the BW Treaty. Now, the gross violations have shown up, and then that does involve our national security doctrine to a substantial degree. And then the bioterrorism questions as a still further manifestation of it. So, and those are things that are working. Things are happening as a result of my involvement there. But in parallel, since 15 years ago, infectious disease is a much broader agenda. I've been working mostly through the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences, the CDC, some interdepartmental government agencies, and trying to put aside the complacency about infectious disease. Now, the AIDS epidemic should have settled that once and for all, but even at that, it's amazing how few people have been able to conceptualize a generalization that if something like AIDS could come up out of the blue, so will a dozen other things, and they will, and they are. So, you know, today's concern is West Nile. Yeah. So the IOM report on emerging infections has had an enormous impact. That was 1992. It's going to go into another edition before long. And I think it has reset the national, even global agenda to some degree. I've been on WHO committees with the same objective. Sorry, such a long-winded answer, but it's not
it's extremely
question.
Helpful. Yeah. it's actually a very helpful way for you to answer it. If we could actually move on to the columns now for a little bit. In Harriet Zuckerman's book, she quotes you as saying that you started the columns partially as a way to protect against distortion. The idea that if you spoke...
Is that in the Nobel Elite?
Yeah, that's in there. That if you... It's either in that or perhaps it's in that one. But the idea that if you spoke for yourself, at least you would get it right.
Yeah, no, that was my immediate motive. Mostly before then with various kinds of space stuff, and they never got it right.
Uh-huh. So what... If you could be a little specific, if you can, what kinds of experiences have you had that led you to this? Just the space stuff in this book?
Well, I don't recall. Well, there must have been some stuff about Algenie as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it certainly was.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry, what the provocations were kind of faded away.
That's fine.
But I recall those attitudes, and Harriet has documented it from pretty early in the game.
Uh-huh.
She must have done that in the late 60s. Couldn't have been much later than that. When did her book come out?
I have a 10th... I think it's mid-80s. Maybe 79?
Oh, hold on.
Okay.
No. What's amusing is that she had solicited me for an interview when she was putting it together, and I had declined.
Mm-hmm.
And then some years later, I got to know her and Bob Merton very, very well and become fast friends. We put a couple of things together and so on. So, but I was trying to guess when that interview might have been. But I saw a great deal of her during the year they were out at Stanford in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was the problem.
Right.
Okay.
In large part, do you think that strategy worked?
Oh, yeah. I was able to speak with my own voice. And not just distortion, but compression. I mean, so many of the things I want to talk about are so nuanced. The interesting questions all are. That a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And
mm-hmm.
I may be very frustrating to some readers in that I tend to complicate most questions, not simplify.
Right.
And that just doesn't come across in somebody else's reporting.
Uh-huh. So did you do many TV or radio spots?
No. I've pretty much systematically defined them. Exactly the reason that I do my own column. I have script control on my column.
Right.
I have no control whatever what appears on a TV show.
How common was it for you to get requests to do, say, television interviews or radio interviews?
I'd say I get one or two a month over the years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, they tend to come in clusters when there's some hot event. Lately it's been about bioterrorism, something of that sort. But and I think they've probably mostly gotten pretty tired of asking.
Mm-hmm.
I've made one or two exceptions. There was a BBC series on emerging infection where I thought they were trustworthy, and they were. That came out okay.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other. But it's just a medium I detest for communication. I think it's great for entertainment, period.
Okay. Many of the columns...
It's not accountable.
Yeah, no, it's not.
You know, somebody, if they even if it's somebody else's reportage, if they really get it wrong, they can be held to account and have to respond to a demand for a correction. You can't do that with TV.
Right. It seems to be getting worse as well. But
okay.
Okay. A lot of the columns, the content seems to have little to do with your scientific expertise. They're things, the ones say on, you know, the voting age or our involvement in Vietnam. How did you pick what you wanted to write about?
As we got to arms control, I felt that although I had entered into the field from a specialist background of a microbiologist, I'd spent a lot of time continuing to work those. The timing's wrong, because that only started in 1970. I was well into my college. I'm putting the cart before the horse. I was still in touch with a lot of scientists who in turn were connected with arms control. Leo Szilard, outstandingly. Mm-hmm. I'd heard a lot of the debates, so I didn't feel like I was a total dummy. I certainly felt I was the match of any of their other political columnists in dealing with those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to stick to things where there was some special scientific angle, but certainly spilled over that, most notably on international security matters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to answer your question.
Mm-hmm.
Things I ended up feeling more strongly about, and then I'd be chided now and then by the editor.
Right.
That, you know, we have much more high-priced columnists than you to deal with those matters.
What about other scientists? Did your colleagues seem... Did it bother your colleagues whenever you would write about non-scientific things?
No, on the contrary. I had... I thought I would get a certain amount of... Josh is trying to grab for the headlines of something of that sort, but, which was not the case. I didn't get that kind of feedback at all. If anything, it would say, you know, we're glad you're doing this for us.
Somebody has to do it.
Much more general attitude. And on specific cases, what I enjoyed the most were people who said, well, you didn't get it quite right. Here's chapter and verse on the detail, and do better next time. For columnists, you did okay. So when I could engage in more substantive discussion on things I opened up, I welcomed it. It's very hard for me to think of anything that I got in the hot water about with my scientific colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were some other public issues, I guess abortion, when that got more angry comments than most anything else.
Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, were there many other scientists that were doing the same thing in other newspapers?
To my knowledge, nobody was doing anything quite like that in terms of a regular series.
Right.
Now, there were occasional contributions from various places, and Hal Marowitz wrote a monthly but not for the general public. That was more of a physician's audience. I guess Steve Gould probably comes as close as anybody, and there again, that's somewhat more narrowly framed.
Mm-hmm.
The National Academy has tried to encourage not single columnists, but it will syndicate a variety of pieces from various sources, so that's probably the nearest mm-hmm. next example.
Right. I mean, one that I know of is that in about 1965, Salvador Luria organized a group of people to do a column in the Boston Globe. So for several months, someone contributed. It wasn't the same person, but
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, they were kind of similar to Man in the Future type things. They were about science and, you know, the future of mankind. But from that, I didn't know if lots of people were doing this in 65.
No, it's very rare. I can see it did peter out, the thing that's all of it. I don't remember ever hearing about that. Is it in his book?
I've seen it at the APS.
Yeah.
They have some of his correspondence about it. And some of his correspondence with the editor.
It's a little surprising, because since I was later on doing similar things, I may have just totally forgotten about it.
Yeah.
It was not a long-standing enterprise.
Mm. Okay.
It's not an easy thing to do, but I'll tell you what got me in the end, where I couldn't do it indefinitely, is that I'm just much more of a scholar than a journalist. And it ended up that I have 20 cabinets full of ancillary material based on the content of the columns, you know, filling in the notes, and if I ever return to this topic again, the follow-on discussion and so on, it just got to be more than I could handle.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't forget about things I'd written about.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided it was time to bring closure to it.
Right.
At one or two occasions, I was going to republish them as a collected works with some further commentary, and that's ended up being my current archival project, and I will annotate the columns ad lib, but I'm not under any deadline to do so, so just as things come along.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about what it must have been like to be at Stanford, one of the quintessential Cold War universities during the 60s. Because of their physics labs and their electronics labs, in the historiography, that's how they've been portrayed. Perhaps it's not so much for the biological sciences, but for some of their other work. Historians of science have kind of jumped on them as kind of a model Cold War university.
They certainly had no weapons laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
They had a major atomic energy department installation, the SLAC facility, which had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the folks involved in it were ardent proponents of arms control, and some of the most successful, Sid Drell and Pete Panofsky. Pete was the director of SLAC at one time. SRI was an affiliate of Stanford, and it deserves most of the credit for what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
They had innumerable contracts, including classified contracts. There was a student reaction about offing them, and they were off.
Right.
They were just disestablished. They were totally independent activity. There was a medium-sized handful of professors who continued to have joint appointments.
Mm-hmm.
Not in physics, that would be the last place, but electrical engineering.
Right, the electronics.
They would be in things like advanced radars and so on.
Uh-huh.
But,
I think it partially
to call Stanford.
Well, I think it's getting that reputation actually because it's behind MIT actually in the amount of funding that it was getting for a large period I think throughout the 60s, because at that time SRI was still considered part of Stanford.
Yes.
Before the students.
Well, maybe even more importantly, you had Department of Energy, which makes bombs,
uh-huh.
which also paid for all of SLAC,
uh-huh.
which has a budget probably comparable to Stanford University.
Right.
So, I mean, if you do the bookkeeping that way, it may seem.
Right, I'm sure it might have. But so, in the biology, in genetics.
But right across the board for the whole university, you know, the mentality of its faculty and the mentality of its administration is not in any way what you'd call Cold Warish. And that's what I'm trying. Oh, there's another reason, though, the Hoover Institution.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the bastion of the Cold War warrior side.
Okay.
Okay. They were all in one place. They were all in one building.
Quarantined away from the rest of you.
Well, they were, yes. They were regarded as pariahs by most of the faculty.
Okay. So you said you tried to avoid kind of classified and clearance and Department of Defense things while you were writing your columns. Did you have much interaction with, did you have any defense contracts or even for any of the information sciences material you were working on?
Oh, yeah, we had DARPA support for work in artificial intelligence,
uh-huh.
which had no military justification whatsoever. It was why it was eventually terminated.
Right.
And there were quite a few. DARPA was inventing the Internet. And 80% of what it was supporting arguably be said to fed into that development. So that was the great Cold War contribution that made.
Right. Did you ever see yourself as either a Cold War or an anti-Cold War scientist?
Well, I didn't. I thought those were simplistic classifications.
Of course.
I'm sure you know that would be the answer. I'd had a jolting experience in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's paradoxical because I shrugged it off. And Leo Szilard had called me, and this is in Lanouette's book about Szilard, by the way, and said, "Josh, where do you think we ought to go?" And I knew what he was talking about. I said, "I'm not going to go anywhere. Nothing's going to happen here.
Uh-huh.
And if it does, there's no place to hide." I was much more naive then than I am now about how things can go wrong during times of crisis.